You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Holly Grabazio is a game designer, a curator, and the author of her first novel, The Husbands. Thank you for joining me, Holly.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a wonderful book in so many ways. I'm wondering if you would discuss, the premise is just wonderful. Could you tell us kind of what the premise is, and did this originate in your games work? Because it feels a little bit like it might have.
Yeah, absolutely. So the basic premise of The Husbands is that there's a woman named Lauren in her early 30s who realizes that her attic is creating a seemingly infinite supply of husbands. She comes back late one night from her best friend's bachelorette party, and her husband is waiting up for her. And this is really weird, because when she went out to the party, she's pretty sure she wasn't married. But, you know, it's 4 a.m. She's been out all night. She barricades herself in the living room and figures out that she'll deal with it in the morning. And while she's in there, she sees, you know, a wedding photo, and the walls are a different color, and his face is the lock screen on her phone. So it's all very confusing. And in the morning, when she goes to confront him about this, he climbs into the attic to change a light bulb. Just give me a moment. Let's talk about this in a second. And when he climbs down, he's a different man. And the walls are a different color again. And the photo's gone. And she gradually figures out that every time a husband climbs into the attic, a different husband climbs down, and the world around her changes a little bit as well, to be the sort of world where this might be someone that she's married to. And, well, you know how books work, right? Things proceed. It doesn't always go entirely according to plan. And yeah, the idea for it definitely partly came through game design. And in fact, when I first had the idea, I thought, oh yeah, this might be a fun little text-based game, just something that people play online for 15 minutes or so. So I spent a day or two knocking around with it as a game, the idea being that you would read what was going on and you would just decide whether to stay or whether to leave, whether to jump to the next one. I didn't have the attic then. I didn't have that kind of process for getting the men in and out of Lauren's life. I just had the idea of jumping between different versions of the world using partners as a way to do that. And it wasn't really fun. I spent a couple of days knocking around the idea, and it just, yeah, it didn't really go anywhere. I didn't have that zhuzh, you know. And so I set it aside and didn't think about it for a while. And then a couple of years later, I came back to it and thought, you know what? The reason that wasn't fun was that it's quite stressful to make those decisions and to jump between them and to sort of feel maybe you've made the wrong one. It's not much fun as a game, but if you didn't have to do that and you saw the character doing it, like, what if it wasn't interactive? What if the things that happen are just written down in order and you start at the beginning and, oh my God, like a book? And yeah, when I came back to it and revisited it with that idea, that approach, it was way more fun. It was more fun to write. It was more fun to read. And yeah, started getting somewhere with it pretty fast.
Well, I have to say that this is a book should be number one for every man who's involved with women, interested in marriage, or otherwise interested in partnering up, because this is a book that gives unvarnished, beautiful perspective of how women view men. And I think that just reading this, I just go, oh my God. That's what she was thinking. Oh, no. Talk about, you know, creating that kind of perspective, which is, it was, you have so much fun with it. And one of the things you do well is to balance it, make it fun to read. We love the character, and we, you know, agree with her on all of her insights.
Yeah, I think Lauren, the viewpoint character, was figuring out what she was like was a really important part of the writing process, obviously. Partly because she's someone who's a bit frightened of getting things wrong, of making a decision and then finding out that it was the wrong decision. And I think for a lot of people, a magic addict that resets the world would be quite hard to come to terms with, right? But for someone like that, where they have this running fear of getting doing things wrong, it's quite refreshing and invigorating in a way, because if she does make a mistake, she can just reset it and like send the husband up, another husband comes down, nothing that she did matters. So I think she finds it quite thrilling in a way that a lot of people might not. And having that sort of viewpoint, I think, was really key for me to sort of getting people into the story and then having fun with it. I didn't want it to be this incredibly sort of stressful thing throughout. There are stressful moments, but I wanted there to be bits of joy and fun and exploration as well. And using Lauren's newfound sense of freedom, I think, was really key there. And in terms of having her perspective on all of the different husbands that she encounters, obviously some of that is, pulled from my own dating days. A lot of it is pulled from sitting with friends while they go through the apps and swipe on people and find a reason almost to say no to someone, because they're approaching it almost like this chore, this thing that they have to do of spending their 10 minutes a day on Tinder or whatever it might be. And maybe they don't really have the intent of following through or meeting up with anyone, but they still feel like it's something they ought to do. So, yeah, just sitting with them and seeing the reasons that they'll find to go, oh, I don't think this would work. Oh, I don't like this guy, was very informative for me.
You know, this book essentially turns a dating app into a kind of magical reality. And I think that's one of the things I love about the book is that you would set up some very simple rules. You follow them relentlessly. And you use the element of the fantastic, what you call the magic attic, to like allow us to see our relationships, the way we talk to one another, the way we feel about ourselves, the way we feel about the decisions that we make, with this really neat perspective. And that's the joy of reading any kind of speculative fiction is to use the element of the fantastic to get outside of your normal life and see things and talk about things that you can't normally talk about. I mean, I can't have a decision, a discussion with my wife. Well, a different wife came down out of the attic today. But I can, but as I read your book, I can enjoy that kind of perspective and get a fresh perspective. Talk about using, the toolkit of the speculative fiction to create what is essentially a romantic comedy.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always really enjoyed books and films and television programs that are sort of fundamentally realistic, that have one weird thing at their heart. So you get a lot of time loops like that, right? Like Groundhog Day and Palm Springs. And you also get a lot of books like that in the 20s and the 1920s and 30s. There's a little trend for them. So there's books like Sylvia Townsend's Lolly Willows, in which is partly about the difficulties of being an unmarried woman at that time, and the way you would often end up sort of living with family members and sort of brought into use raising other people's children and be very constrained in what was considered acceptable behavior for you. So it's partly about that, but it's also a little bit about how she sells her soul to the devil, which happens in a kind of casual way about a third of the way through. And it isn't even a very major part of the book, but it's just this little thing at its heart. So this kind of basically realist, but with one strange thing that allows you to approach the world in a different, more peculiar, sort of maybe sometimes more direct way is a genre that I've always really enjoyed. So yeah, as soon as I had this sort of thinking about the jumping between different partners, the moment it really clicked for me was thinking about a specific friend's flat in South London and the landing at the top of the stairs into her flat and the attic above that. And I'm from Australia, right? We don't have attics. We have, like, there might be a space above the ceiling and under the roof, but that's just for spiders and heat. No one stores anything there. We have sheds instead. So for me, attics were always quite weird and magical anyway, because they were things that came in children's books where maybe there was a pathway through to another world, right? Or there were things that came in these 19th century novels where maybe there's a secret wife trapped up there. Spoilers for Jane Eyre. And so being in London, moving to London and having friends who would say things like, oh yeah, that might be up in the attic. I don't really know what's up there. I haven't looked for 6 months. And they just had this whole extra room in their house full of secrets. Yeah, the moment it really clicked for me was when I thought, oh, that's where the husbands come from. And I could just sort of pull on that thread and see where it took me.
One of the things I really liked about this book is that it's not just the husband that changes, but her entire world. And this is a very interesting incarnation of the many worlds thesis, that, you know, the universe is infinite because it consists of all of the infinite decisions any human might have made and winding through lives. So talk, was that originally part of the idea or did that come in later?
Oh, I think that was definitely originally part of the idea for me. I think I tend to be very aware of how the places that I am and the things that I do are contingent on things that happened 10 or 20 or 30 even years ago, like the high school subjects that I happened to enroll in, that kind of thing. Partly because I can trace my game design career back to a very specific and quite unlikely moment, which was in the late 90s, I went to my local bookshop to try to find a book of Latin poetry in parallel translation, Latin and English, because that was the sort of obnoxious teenager that I was. I didn't really read Latin. I just thought it would be cool to have. So I went to the secondhand bookshop and was browsing in the foreign languages section and found a book called Metamagical Themas by Douglas Hofstadter. And you can see why they'd put it in the Latin section. It sounds a bit like it might be Latin if you're not paying attention. But it was actually a collection of columns that he wrote for Scientific American in, I think, the early 80s. And one of them was about a game called Gnomic, which is a game where you vote to change the rules as part of playing it. And I thought that sounded really interesting. And a few years later, when I began using the internet a little bit more, I found an online group playing Gnomic. And I joined in on that, not for very long, but just for, you know, a few months, and got to know some of the people. And then some of them turned out to be professional game designers. And I thought, oh, I didn't even know that was a job. I didn't know that was a thing that people could do. I'd always liked playing games, but I didn't realize that was something that you could get paid for. And so I don't think I would have ended up going into game design if someone hadn't put that book on the wrong shelf in the sort of mid-late 90s. And so I don't think everyone has something that's that stark and visible. Not everyone can see this tiny glitchy mistake is why I am where I am now. But I do think where everyone is contingent on a lot of these sort of tiny moments that we don't necessarily notice. And absolutely, that includes the people in our lives. When I think about the friends that I've made or the hobbies that I have or the suburbs that I know about, the suburb that I live in London now, I live in because a friend lived there and I had coffee with her and she pointed around and was like, oh, isn't this lovely? And my husband and I, of whom I have one husband precisely. And we thought, yeah, this is lovely. Maybe we should try moving here. So then everything that happens after that is the sort of knock-on effect from that, right? So how much more the people that you live with, right, must they be affecting day to day your hobbies, what things you watch, what stuff you cook, what things you eat, where you go on holiday. Then maybe you go on holiday somewhere and you see something in a museum that gives you an idea to do something else. Like we can't always trace them directly, but we know that the influences are there knocking us around in the world.
Well, too, the many worlds thesis, you know, happens to us every day. And here's a great excerpt from your book. God, it's so true of me. She has a real flashlight somewhere. It used to be in a drawer, but in this world, she eventually finds it on top of the fridge. This is an everyday experience for me. I have a little flashlight that I use when I take the dogs for a walk, and God, it just seems to grow legs and walk various places. I'm like, oh my God. And so
you're accidentally sliding between a couple of universes there.
Not impossible. And I think that this is one of the joys of reading this book. It's the insights that it brings into everyday life. Now, one of the things I really like, too, are the characters. The characters are just really wonderful. Talk about Lauren and her neighbors and just where she lives, because that really feels real. And I can see that. You were talking about the landing and the stairs and the attic. I mean, I can see that. It's like a cross between an apartment my grandmother used to live in 60, 70 years ago and our house now.
Yeah, that's her flat. Lauren's flat is very much based on a specific friend's flat in Norwood Junction in South London, the friend with the mysterious attic who would just shove stuff up there. Yeah, it's a very specific sort of type of flat. And actually, I had quite a lot of discussion with my editors, my US and my UK editor, trying to find the words that would communicate what the flat was like, because it's sort of this very specific layout that not everyone is familiar with. The idea that you would have a flat or an apartment that's like one floor up and then there's another one underneath, but you still have an attic. That's not necessarily a normal layout that people understand instinctively. So you don't want to have a chapter that's just like, okay, everyone, sit down. I've drawn a floor plan. We need to explain exactly how this flat is laid out so that you're on board for the rest of the story, right? But you also don't want people to be sitting there going, I don't understand how this works. This is weird to me. So in fact, to talk it through with my editors, I ended up sending them the listing for my friend's flat on the sort of a rental site, going like, this is it. This is why I'm using these words. What do you think? What's a way that we can get this across a little bit clearer? So I'm so happy that it came through to you. But yeah, I think I knew that Lauren was going to be someone who struggled with decisions, because that's the sort of person for whom an attic like this can be initially a delight and then increasingly something that's very difficult to deal with. So that was kind of at the heart of her. And then the rest of her character very much developed through sort of seeing how she reacted to different situations and what made sense there. And also through forming the other characters around her. You mentioned her neighbours who sort of live downstairs from her. And they're in there really because I wanted her to have some connections, some close connections that made sense and that were still there across all of the different versions of the world. I wanted her to have some kind of grounding, like turn up in a new universe, new husband, new walls, sometimes a new job even. It needed to have some sort of sense of continuity there to ground her and also to give the reader something to kind of grab onto. So she has family members and she has friends who live more distantly, but having these downstairs neighbours was really important to me, I think, and that kind of relationship. And yeah, they were fun to write because I wanted them to not be, I wanted her to care about them, but for them not to be too intrusive and curious about what was weird that was going on with her and why their neighbor was behaving so strangely. So one of them, Toby, is just very sort of laid back and relaxed and kind of takes things in stride and is like, oh yeah, okay, Lauren's asking me some weird questions, Lauren's behaving strange, that's okay, fine. Whereas his partner Mariam is very just not that interested in the world around her most of the time. She's quite busy. She's quite self-obsessed in a way that I find charming, but perhaps not everyone does. And so she doesn't necessarily notice when weird things are going on, which I think makes the two of them a good pairing, but also like some fun people to have around to ground Lauren in her experience, if that makes sense.
And, you know, it's now time to talk about some of the husbands. And one of the things that really makes this book pop, for me at least, is her reaction to the husbands. It serves both the purpose of turning the pages, but also it's just the insights are great. Sometimes a husband will pop up and you know, he'll have like some food on his, stuck in his beard or something. And sends him right back up to the attic. And one thing I noticed, I thought you do this very effectively, is you use that kind of instant, you know, hard no in as a kind of language construct throughout the book. Was this on purpose?
Yeah, I think I wanted a way to kind of express the sort of instinctive, like, oh, maybe, no, yeah, no sort of feeling that we tend to have looking through profiles in online dating without really knowing very much about the people at all. A thing that happened to me is that several months after I met my husband, he sat up and was like, oh no, and told me that he had received a message on his online dating profile that he had forgotten he had. And so he sort of rushed to disable it, delete the profile. And I said, oh, but you've got to let me see it first. You've got to let me see the profile and have a look at it. And I looked at his profile and yeah, I wouldn't have sent him a message. I would have gone like, oh, no, I don't think so. It wasn't terrible, but it was very work focused. It had an exclamation mark on the end of every sentence. It was very cheery and earnest. And I tended to feel more drawn to profiles that were a little bit, a little bit more sidelong, a little bit less enthusiastic, and like slightly sort of sarcastic or sly or something like that. And a very earnest profile of like 9 sentences about work with an exclamation mark after each one. There's nothing wrong with it, but I would have gone, oh, I don't think that's going to work out. And I saw it and I just had that instinctive like no thing. And by this stage, we've been dating several months and I was very fond of him. And I felt like maybe this would be a quite long lasting thing. And so feeling that response in me to the profile was really, really interesting. That kind of like, oh, no, no. And the way that setup really encourages you to make these snap judgments and sort of look for a reason to go, oh, no, about something, in a way that when you meet someone in person, I met Terry at a conference, we both work in games. When you meet someone in person, you're not looking for the same reason to dismiss them, right? So yeah, I wanted to take that kind of instinctive note feeling that I think for some people, online dating can encourage, and put that at the heart of some of Lauren's responses.
As I mentioned, one of the things that I found intriguing in this novel was to be inside Lauren's head and see, you know, her reactions, not just the men around her, but also the world around her. She is a great character. And I think that one of the things that really makes this book, I mean, I could not turn the pages fast enough to find out what the heck was going to happen. And one of the things that makes this book work really well is the prose. Your prose is very light. It's fun. It's really easy to read. But you're discussing some subjects by virtue of, you know, your premise and the people that are not always easy, you know, rejecting lovers and getting rid of people. I mean, it's not an easy task. So talk about creating that kind of prose that is makes you turn the pages, is fun and light, but discusses some subjects that are themselves not necessarily fun and light.
Yeah, absolutely. I tried a couple of different voices and approaches in the early stages of writing it, but I ended up having this sort of very close third person present tense point of view on Lauren's thoughts, so that we're always with Lauren's thoughts happening quite immediately. Partly because, you know, she does do some quite outlandish things and the whole setup is very peculiar on the face of it. So I wanted to sort of be able to take people with it and with sort of accepting it as she did, to like have people go, wait, what? That doesn't make sense. Oh, I get what's happening. Oh, okay. As Lauren does, and kind of carry people through it together. So that's why I ended up with that particular kind of immediate sort of close third on Lauren. And then it turned out to be very useful later on in things like showing her reactions to particular husbands, or building up to sometimes quite ill-advised responses to her different situations. And yeah, I think I wrote it all in a very kind of scattered way. I didn't particularly start at the beginning and write towards the end. I wrote things that seemed like they would be fun to write as they came to me, very much out of order.
Oh,
and
really?
So I think I was, So at the end of the first draft, let's call it a first draft, but honestly, it was just 150,000 words, way too many words. Final book is about 100,000. Some no ending, some scenes I'd written four times, some bits I hadn't bothered to write at all that I thought, oh, I probably need this, but I can't be bothered at the moment. But it was very much driven by what do I feel like writing at the moment. And then once I had this huge pile of stuff, I got into the editing process of shaping it around. And so I think part of the fun in the sentences, if that makes sense, is just because I was always writing a thing that I felt like writing. Like, I love editing. So as soon as I got to the editing stage, I was having a great time with that. I don't always love writing new stuff as much as I love editing. So being very much driven by what do I feel like writing now meant that I was always having fun with that part of it as well, which I hope comes through.
You know, there are some fantastic characters in here, and without telling us exactly too much about them, Bohai is an absolute joy. So talk about creating Bohai, and again, don't tell us too much about him. He's one of the potential husbands.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a lovely time writing him for a couple of reasons. But one of them is just that he's an Australian. And although I've been in the UK for 15 years, and I think I'm broadly on top of, you know, what the English are like categorically, there's still a little bit of like arm's length. Would an English man say this? And some stuff where I thought I'd got it, but then when I showed it to sort of English readers and to my editors, they'd go like, oh no, this isn't quite right, just like a couple of little tweaks. Even things like the downstairs neighbor Toby was originally called Hayden because he's a man in his early to mid 30s, and approximately 50% of Australian men in their early to mid 30s are called Hayden or Lachlan. But it turns out that English men are not called Hayden or Lachlan when they're that age. There's Haydens, but they're much younger. It became a trendy name later on. So little things like that. But also, you know, what food do people eat? Like, what's their comfort food? Just little things like that. All of the assumptions that you bed in as a child, right? And that you never quite dislodge however long you're in another country. So just on that level, writing an Australian character and not having to always go, oh, is this plausible for an English person, was an incredible, relaxing joy for me. And yeah, I just really wanted him to be someone that Lauren could have a fun time with, could have conversations that she enjoyed, and just have this kind of slightly different sort of connection to. And so he was a real pleasure to write. And I wanted him to also act in some ways as a kind of counterpoint to Lauren. So Lauren struggles with making decisions because she's worried about getting things wrong, fundamentally. Whereas he struggles with decisions because he doesn't really like relinquishing any of his power to make choices. He doesn't like it when other people make decisions that he has to then abide by. He has this kind of instinctive revulsion for it. And I'm not great at decisions for both of those reasons simultaneously, which is an incredibly inconvenient combination, I can tell you that. So pulling those two out and sort of putting them in different characters and then making those characters spend time together was a lot of fun.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was how much we like the husbands that Lauren likes. There are a couple that she stays with some time, and I thought, boy, this is a, even when we first meet him, we think, this guy's a good character. I hope, you know, he hangs out for a while. And on the other hand, there's one husband in particular who hangs out a bit too long. Not that they long for the plot, but you can just say, oh my God, this guy's kind of jerk. Talk about creating the characters of the husbands, and especially the ones who hang out for longer and are, you know, kind of okay.
Yeah. They are all people that Lauren might have married, right? So they all, even if the if they're only around for a sentence or two, you don't get to learn much about them. But for any of the husbands that hung around longer, I wanted to know for myself what about them made the relationship work. Why was Lauren interested in them? Why were they interested in Lauren? What's the thing going on there that makes them functional as a couple or dysfunctional as a couple, as the case may be? And so, yeah, I was very much thinking about things like, what is Lauren's job usually, and what types of people might she meet in that job? And things like, if you're someone who struggles with decision making, what sort of partners might make that easy for you? Like, so, you know, whether that's someone who's very judgmental and is like, oh no, that's wrong, that kind of gives you this sort of almost spotlight through the world just by casting the rest of it into darkness, right? Like pointing at a bunch of stuff going, oh, that's bad. And therefore making it, if you're with them, making it easier for you to go like, yeah, that probably is bad. The things that you don't hate are probably the things that are okay. Or whether it's someone who's very methodical about decision making and thinking things through and trying to optimize their choices, the different ways that people can respond to just the challenge of being in the world with a bunch of choices to make and thinking how that might fit in with her. And so for the husbands that stick around for longer, I really wanted there to be a core to their relationship, which was how they are together, that made sense of why that might exist, why that might be a thing that involved two people sticking together and in fact eventually getting married. And I had to have that sort of in my head in order to be able to write them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And also, too, another thing I think that you do well is the premise itself. There's an attic and husbands come out of it. And I think you do a really good job of making it have enough logic that it's not completely out there. It's not like it's not magic in the sense of, you know, witches or something like that, or cast a spell on you or anything. And the thing that works really well and is also lots of fun are all the different worlds that Lauren finds herself surrounded in, just slightly different. And I think, you know, that comes also from, you know, something, the joy in that comes from the fact that we all consider, you know, sometimes you walk down and you're in the grocery store or shopping or something, and you think, oh, what if I was just shopping for myself or for somebody else or blah, blah, blah. I mean, we all consider these alternate paths for ourselves, and you flesh it out well enough so that it all makes, you know, a certain amount of sense, and that you keep the readers successfully for the entire novel. You keep the readers questioning at bay as what's going on exactly in that attic. And that is a masterful piece of work. It's incredibly difficult. I read the whole damn book and I enjoyed every page of it, and I was never too bothered, you know, to figure out, you know. So talk about creating an element of the fantastic that remains as successful and fantastic. On one hand, you create those alternate worlds, but you don't put too much effort into it so that the reader doesn't put a whole lot of effort into figuring out what's going on. We just want to be along for the ride.
Yeah. I did do a lot of thinking about that. And in fact, at one point, I thought, should I be doing more to explain the attic? And I made this huge chart of a lot of sort of books and films that I like that have this kind of one weird thing at their heart, like the husbands. And for each one, I wrote down, what's the weird thing? How do we learn about it? Is it ever explained? If it's explained, are we glad that it's explained? And I found that there were very, very few cases where you have this sort of setup with this sort of one sort of magical-esque hook that acts as the engine for the plot, where when they explained it, I was glad that that explained it. Usually when there was an explanation, it made me go like, oh, didn't really need that. And when there wasn't an explanation, it didn't leave me longing for one. So I thought, okay, good, that seems like a clear steer. I didn't really want to explain it, so I'm glad that that's how the chart worked out. And yeah, I think it's partly showing Lauren's responses to it and the ways that she understands the rules of how it works and how she does try to figure things out a little bit and experiment with it, but also comes to accept and understand how the rules work that hopefully carry the reader along with them. But also things like thinking about what could go wrong with this, having this very clear concept of fundamentally how it works, what the rules are.
One of the aspects of this book that is really nice is that after a while, Lauren becomes kind of addicted to this. It's like there's always a new choice. She becomes addicted to thinking, well, maybe the next guy will be even better. Talk about the cycle of almost addiction, and also, you know, the import of regret in this novel. Regret is an emotion that plays a huge part in our lives. It's not often, you know, mentioned or discussed, but I think we all think about, you know, the things that we did do or didn't do, or the choice we made or didn't make, that, you know, we wouldn't mind being back in our shoes again to try to make a better choice. So talk about, you know, the import of regret and the addictive qualities of having endless choice.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think the sort of addictiveness of like next is very true, isn't it? Like that's the mechanism behind a lot of gambling, right?
I never thought about that, yes.
Like, oh, I'll press the button again, pull the lever again, this time. And yeah, similarly, I think when people are, some people love dating via the apps, but some people really just don't get on well with it. And I was talking to someone who described it as being like, even when you're on a date, you're thinking that there might be someone better in your pocket. And so I think that element of just always being able to sort of press a button or pull a lever or swipe or say, hey, would you put this box back up in the attic for me? Thanks. And see what's next is very, very compelling. It's difficult to stop. You always, you want to know. You're like, oh, what's around the corner, right? And I think the way that interfaces with regret for me and this in this particular case is just this sense of all of these worlds being there and being accessible in some way. And And like normally when we regret, we think things like, oh, what if I'd done this? What if I'd done that? And a lot of the time we can talk ourselves into thinking, oh, it probably wouldn't have been that great. We don't know what would have happened. Something else might have gone wrong, blah, blah, blah. But because Lauren is sort of seeing wholescale worlds and jumping between them, it's kind of harder for her to go, oh, that would have been bad. That would have been bad. She knows what the different worlds were like. And she's able to continue to access new worlds, but just not the ones she's left, right? So this kind of combination of not just wondering, but knowing what a different version of her life might have been like, but also having this seemingly infinite supply of options that doesn't include any of the ones that she's already said no to or skipped past, I think makes for a very sort of challenging situation for her to come to terms with, to work out how to accept regret within, or to accept that you can't live all of your lives at once, and that there's always going to be something you slightly regret just because you can't do everything at once. Like, here I am in Adelaide, where I grew up. Beautiful, beautiful city. Here I am sitting under a tree, blue skies behind me, art gallery over there, museum over there. Later I'm going to go down to the gorgeous Outdoors Writers Week Festival and have a coffee with a friend and sit on the grass and just have a really nice time. And every time I'm in Adelaide, I think, it's so nice here. It's so nice. And I wish I could live here and also live in London, but I can't. And so I don't have an option that isn't regret. If I move to Adelaide, then I'll think about London and all of my friends there and the thrum of stuff going on constantly and the hubbub of it and the sense of being in a place that so many people have chosen actively to be, sometimes in situations of like it's not a great rental market, but it's still full of people who are like, no, this is where I want to be. And so if I wasn't there, I'd regret that. But also, this is so nice. Why did I decide to leave this incredibly lovely place and go to a grey land of people being a bit grumpy all the time, right? you can't have a life without regrets, even if we accept that there is a best decision for everyone, which probably there isn't, and even if you manage to make the best decision every time, there's still versions of your life that you can't have at the same time.
You know, one of the things that Lauren encounters is every time she has a new husband, she has a different or slightly different or wildly different job to go to. And on one hand, she's able to, you know, just call in sick for the 2 or 3 days she's running through the test session. So she doesn't have to go to work for quite some time. But on the other hand, she has to sometimes show up for jobs where she knows nothing about. And I think you just do a magnificent job of capturing, using your magical realism to recreate a dream that every human being on earth has, where they show up at school for a test and you are entirely unprepared and you know you're going to fail it and you're just completely freaked out by that. Because Lauren, there's one scene where Lauren shows up for a job she knows nothing about. I'm just thinking, oh my God. This is the tested school dream brought to life again. And I thought, well, what a great way to use the fantastic in order to discuss something that is hard to talk about. And you know, this constant feeling that I think many of us feel at any second, you might turn around and all of a sudden your life becomes incomprehensible and you cannot deal with it anymore.
Yeah, this fear that someone's going to jump out at you and go, you don't know what you're doing, do you?
Exactly.
And in Lauren's case, the answer really is quite often, no, I have no idea. She'll be in a different role. She'll work in an entirely different industry. She'll have got a promotion and she'll be the boss of her old position, whatever it might be. Yeah. I think that was fun to think about. And she quite often, I think one of the things about her is that she does get stuck in things quite easily when she isn't using the sort of mechanism of resetting the world. So she's quite often in the same job. She's in the same flat all the time, right? Or you wouldn't be able to have the husband climbing down from the attic. So she is to some extent a creature of habit. But I think that makes it, if anything, more frightening when you suddenly find yourself in an entirely different job going, I don't know how this works. How do you operate a cash register? Who is this person coming up and asking whether I have the report? What report?
Also, I have to say, yes, you do stick the landing. Ends wonderfully. I don't want you to tell us how it ends, but in a book that is based on endless happy and unhappy endings, so to speak, since so many books and movies end with a wedding, somebody being married. How did you figure out, was it a difficult task for you to stick the ending?
It was. I knew what I wanted the sort of emotional heft and the sort of intent of the ending was going to be. I knew what, you know, I guess the message or whatever we want to call it was going to be, but I didn't know how I was going to express that in plot terms at all. And when I first wrote the big sprawling 150,000 word version, I actually wrote a sort of 8 different branching endings. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea. I'm not a big fan of ambiguous endings, so I don't know why I thought, but I'll write 8 different endings. That'll be a great idea. But I did. And they were a bit of a mess. I never showed those to anyone, but I did a sort of a cut down version of that with sort of 2 or 3 different endings. And that was the version that went to my agent, and she read it and she gave me some various feedback, which was like, yeah, this seems good. It's a bit long. Can you cut it down a little bit more? Also, do you think you can write a better ending? And I just spent a month stomping around thinking, if I could have thought of a better ending, I would have written a better ending in the first place. And then eventually I went back to that sort of original set of 8 kind of haphazard, not very fully thought through endings, and found one of those and thought, wait a minute, what if I build this up? What if this is the thing that happens at the end? Could that work? And kind of work to put that together and expand that. And yeah, once I'd put the work in there, it felt right. It felt like the place that things were leading.
Have you been approached to make this into a quote, show my age miniseries or movie?
I am not currently permitted to answer any questions relating to that.
Oh, well, that is fantastic. I mean, one of the things that's fun about reading this sort of book, the way this is written, is to cast it as you go. And I'm wondering, did you do that yourself?
I didn't really. During the process of writing it, it didn't occur to me. I was trying to figure out, you know, who the people I was writing were. And that kind of took precedent over who could then perform them. That didn't occur to me as a thing during the writing process. But once it was out, this is a thing that people have sometimes asked me at book events and things like that. And the answer is kind of, oh, not really. Partly because if it were to be made into a series, I would want to be sort of free to be excited by the casting. I wouldn't want to be sitting there going, oh, in my head, I'd cast this other person. But
so you'd want to have the magic attic of actors to hand as opposed to
I think so. But I have had people send me like little fan casts I've done, like lists of people that they think could be great in different roles. And I love that. That's always so much fun to see someone just, oh, I think this person could be Lauren. Oh, I think this person could be Carter. That's just an absolute joy to see what other people imagine. And quite often I think it'd be incredible. I would love that.
You are by trade a games writer. And you've done an incredible transition to a novel writing. Have you started your next novel?
I have. I'm in the quite early stages still. So there's not that much I can say about it. But I can say it's another comedy. It doesn't have a magic thing at its heart, like The Husbands does. But like The Husbands, it is quite weird. And it's set in a zoo.
Another question that comes to mind is, how did you think of this novel? Did you think, well, here's a fun piece of speculative fiction? Or did you think, here's a fun twist on a rom-com? I mean, was your approach coming from the speculative side or the romantic comedy side?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I did not really know when I was writing it. When I was writing it, I didn't know that it would find a publisher, obviously. I read a lot of posts about how many people write novels and how few of them find an agent and how many few of the ones that find an agent then get published. So I tried not to get caught up too much in exactly what genre is this while I was writing it, because I was already feeling quite overwhelmed by just all of the statistics of how hard it is to get books published. And then once I'd finished it, I looked at it and I was like, what sort of book is this? Not really sure. I read most things. I don't read horror because I'm a giant coward and I can't deal with horror. But I read a lot of speculative. I read a lot of literary fiction. I read a lot of rom-coms. And I read a lot of sort of nonfiction and essays and weirdly structured things. I love a weird structure. So I feel like it kind of came out of that sort of tendency to read in a very mood-based way. That's more, what do I feel like reading now, rather than what genre do I feel like reading now? And it is a little bit difficult sometimes to figure out how to talk about it and how to describe it. I think it definitely, so for example, you mentioned rom-coms, and it does have a lot of the feel of a rom-com to it. But I would say it doesn't have the core promise of a rom-com, which is generally that you know pretty early on who's going to end up together, and then you have a sort of path towards the end where they get together. And if that's what you're in the mood for, that's absolutely what you want to get. And it doesn't deliver that. It does a slightly different thing that has the feeling of a rom-com, but skips out on that core promise. So I try not to refer to it as a romance myself, or as a rom-com, without putting that little warning in there, because yeah, I know that if I'm in the mood for a rom-com and then I get something that doesn't fulfill that core plot promise, then I'm not going to be super happy as a reader. Obviously it does have the kind of speculative element in it, but once that is taken as given, it doesn't explore that in huge detail. It's just like, here are the rules. Let's have fun with the rules. So yeah, didn't really know what genre it was going to be. Still kind of vague on what genre it is. It's been shelved in a lot of different places in bookshops. It quite often ends up in the sort of general fiction area, but I've also seen it listed under speculative, under like women's fiction, under literary fiction, under rom-coms. Not totally sure.
I'm here to tell every fellow out there who reads books, The Husbands is a book you need to read, because you may actually someday be a husband, in which case you should know how you're seen. The new novel by Holly Gramazio is The Husbands. Thank you for joining me, Holly.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a fun chat.
You've You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.